The government recently announced plans to shake up the building materials sector, making it easier to introduce products from, quote, trusted jurisdictions, unquote. Currently, before a building product or material can be used on site, builders have to demonstrate that it meets the standards laid out in the New Zealand Building Code by going through a domestic application and a testing process. Under the newly proposed system, they would be able to rely instead on certifications from trusted overseas jurisdictions. For example, MBIE, the Ministry of Building, Innovation and Employment, could approve the Australian Watermark certification for use in Aotearoa New Zealand, making all the products it covers available here. The aim is to increase product choice and decrease the costs of construction. Building and Construction Minister Chris Penk says it's, quote, 50% more expensive to build a standalone house here than in Australia, unquote. While the industry's broadly welcomed the move, there are some concerns over ensuring this doesn't open the door to substandard materials and or installation. Rick Hurd is the former chief executive of construction company Naylor Love. Good morning, Rick.
Morena, Catherine, how are you?
Really good, thanks. And Paul Grimshaw has spent a career as a lawyer specialising in building and construction and particularly prominent during the Leakey Homes cases. Thanks both of you for your experience this morning. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Catherine.
So, Rick, can we start with you? Can you talk us through your understanding of how these changes are going to work? Obviously, there's a lot more detail to be worked out, but what do you understand?
Well, the fundamental aim is to provide a greater opportunity for selection of materials and products for the building industry. And in principle, that's a good thing. The issue always will come down to who's going to take accountability if there's a problem with any of the products, and that has been the issue right through the Leakey Building situation. And even today, when products come into the country which are purportedly meeting appropriate standards and they don't, then who pays for the cost of the remediation of the work? That's the fundamental issue we've got to overcome.
That, and I'm sure Paul will point out also, that that's a long and painful and financially stressful process. We don't want another failure on that scale, and I know there are still issues right now in construction, well and truly. But could you just talk us through, Rick, what difference it will have on the building and consents process for companies large and small? What happens now?
Well, what happens now, if we want to, as you said in your introduction, if we want to introduce a new product, we have to basically prove that it's suitable. But for example, we've recently at Naylor Love, before I retired, had a situation where we subcontract ours was using imported cable. It was stamped with the appropriate New Zealand and Australian standard, that so you would have to, on face value, accept that this product had been tested to the appropriate standards. But when some independent testing was taken locally in New Zealand, it proved that it didn't meet those standards. In fact, we had to pull it out of about 70-odd apartments. The subcontractor that supplied that material went into liquidation, and so we ended up carrying the cost of all the remediation to those apartments. And that is the issue we've got. We need one organisation within the whole construction supply chain to take accountability. And we don't have that situation at the moment, and Paul will be well aware that most what's typically happened around New Zealand since the Leakey Building is the ratepayers of New Zealand have covered the lion's share of the cost of repairing remediating the buildings which have been leaky, which is just simply unfair. That isn't the situation, because what happens is the designers, developers and contractors on most situations fold because they can't carry the costs of the remediation.
Which is really interesting, because I'll read from the MBIE statement that I'll read later, and in part it references just this. The Building Act provides broad protection from liability for certain parties, including the chief executive and employee agent, from all civil proceedings for anything done or omitted in good faith. This is talking about how building consent authorities will still need to assess proposed building work to ensure products are being used for their stated purpose and that the building will comply with the building code. But come back to what you just highlighted there. With that imported cable, it had the appropriate certifications from what might now become trusted jurisdictions, but when you did the local test you were required to do, you found a problem.
Yes, that's correct. And so that is the type of situation that can arise. So we've really got to, in my view, it's not about the imported material. That's just part of the problem. We've got to change the industry. The structure of the industry needs to change. But there's a well-publicised case at the moment in Tauranga of a council that built a car parking building, the Tauranga Council. And that particular project, where there was issues with the design, and it turns out that well through the construction process, it was determined that the design was inadequate. This building wasn't up to standard. So the council had already paid $20 million to a designer and contractors to build the building. And then what happens, they had to sell it for a dollar because it was essentially worthless. They then turn around and sue the designers who had made the error. And it turns out that their contract for services had allowed them to limit their liability to what is normally, and Paul might have a better idea than this for me, but I think it's pretty typically about four times their fee, which is well below what the actual cost of the remediation should be. So again, this is a situation where the client's carrying the can in that situation, which is just totally unjust. So how do we change, forget about for the moment just importing the products, but how do we change the sector to make it work more efficiently? And so we're not having reliability problems. How do we become more productive? How do we really reduce costs in this country? I have some views on that, but you probably need to let Paul have a chat.
I'll come back to it, but let's stay with the immediate changes. We've got the construction minister on, building construction minister on Monday. I want to talk to him about the earthquake changes, and I certainly want to talk to him about these changes as well. So we'll return to this topic. On the question of the materials themselves, though, another issue, Rick, was, and we hear this during the leaky buildings, and we've actually heard it in more recent issues, high-profile issues. Oh, it's not the product. It's that it wasn't installed properly. And this is another issue, isn't it? If we're going to start accepting a broader range of products, which on the face of it is fantastic for competition and hopefully price, it's not just the product itself. It's about the skills and experience of those installing it, Rick.
As soon as you have a problem with a leaky window, for example, that is quite a typical situation. You'll have the supplier, you'll have the main contractor saying to the supplier that it's your problem. The supplier will say no, it's a design issue. So you'll have this situation where everyone's pointing the finger, and then it has to go through a legal process to determine what actually happened, and that is just it adds cost. So we've got to get to that situation where one person is clearly accountable in the process, and I actually think, in my view, this needs to be the contractor. But most of the contractors in New Zealand are too small to actually stand behind a failure of a product or their workmanship. And this is the fundamental issue we have. We have a highly fragmented industry. I think about 95% of construction organisations in New Zealand employ less than five people. So that means their balance sheets are very small. They don't have the strength of calibre or of capacity and capability to build buildings and actually stand behind them. So if you go back 20 years ago when Fletcher's was in its heyday, and they were an organisation that had that strength, they imported materials, they manufactured materials, they could build buildings very effectively and they would stand behind their product. We have very few large, we don't have anybody of that scale in the country anymore, but I believe we need three or four large contractors competing against each other, investing in research and development and innovation, who will import these products and not have the local supply chain dictating to them what the margins are going to be and what they should be using. But they need to be strong enough to stay in behind those products. So if there is an issue, then they can afford to rectify it.
The problem is that's the exact inverse of the way the industry is. And right now we're going to see it again, regrettably.
Correct.
One of the consequences of a recession is that you will see these smaller construction companies fall.
Yes.
Inevitably, I think we hit something like 2,000 during the GFC and counting. So the problem is at the moment, Rick, we don't have that system. I want to pick up on one final comment you made, which is the reference to the local suppliers dictating the price. Where do they sit in this? I mean, who realistically is going to do the importing of these new products, and especially when they're used by a bunch of smaller construction companies?
That's exactly right. And if you get an entrepreneur who goes and does a visit to China, finds a U-Butte product, brings it back to New Zealand, sets up it's half the price of product available locally, so everybody wants to use it, and all of a sudden there's a problem. What happens? That small importer winds up his business, and the contractors are left holding the baby. So, and invariably there'll be small organisations, subcontractor organisations that also fall over, and so the process goes on. That is the issue we've got to overcome in this country if we really want to drive down construction costs. And it's because when you get a small and efficient organisation, everyone thinks, well, if they make a mistake, they pay the bill, it's their cost. But what actually happens is they build their risks into their pricing, so they've got very large margins and contingencies, and they can afford to make mistakes until they make a very large one, and then it's all over. And it's all this inefficiency that's built into our whole construction processes where we're in the situation we are today.
But that duopoly, as some would refer to it, that I'm talking about, the PlaceMakers and I think it's Carters, it's the other big one, that tend to supply most builders, are they going to be in the front lines here as well in terms of sourcing new products, or are they the ones where this change envisages others bringing in new products to compete with them and bring prices down?
Well, if they want to compete, and they will be out looking for more competitive products themselves, and that's a good thing. That's exactly what we want. But you will also have the one-off entrepreneurs who finds a product that they think they can make a fortune on and will start bringing into the country and compete against those big ones. But the issue is that the most builders want convenience. They want to be able to go to one-stop shop and go and buy their nails and their jib board and their timber and their glues, etc. And so those larger distributors like PlaceMakers, ITM, etc., Carters, they will continue to exist because they can provide that one-stop shop and service to the contractors that need. Contractors like to work on a just-needed, just-in-time basis. They don't want to have a great stack of materials on their site. They want to just go and get what they need for their day. That's often how the smaller builders work.
Just a final comment before we come to Paul on this concept of trusted jurisdictions. Just reading from the MB statement again, because again, exact details not available, but they are saying the proposal's making it easier to use products that meet standards from trusted jurisdictions. It's targeted at whole standard organisations from overseas. The proposal to streamline recognition of international standards targets individual standards from overseas. The proposal mandating acceptance of products certified overseas targets individual products, groups or classes of products, and product certification schemes. Even within trusted jurisdictions, wherever they end up landing, Rick, do we still have incidences where we will have products with issues coming in? Those countries themselves grapple with this.
Yeah. And look, we have products that have been tested and proven in New Zealand which have failed, and it's not unusual. So so the key issue is that who is liable in that situation. Again, Naylor Love's doing a very large project in Wellington, replacing all the copper pipe in the major public hospital in Newtown, because the copper was substandard, and that was brought in for jurisdiction. It had been supposedly manufactured to the standards, but it wasn't. It failed. The supplier of that product, which was a large New Zealand company, settled with the Te Whatu Ora, and now we, Naylor Love, that is, have now got the contract to replace it. So these sorts of things are not new. They happen all the time.
Okay, stay with us. Thank you, Rick. Paul Grimshaw, let's bring you in now. Of course, you spent many years working on the Leakey Building scandal in particular, and picking up the pieces in some ways for those who were on the receiving end. It was in part linked to imported new materials, not solely. Can you explain a little bit more about how you're looking at this change and the role of materials in it?
Well, I can understand the reason for doing it. In one respect, it's laudable in the sense that they want to get the costs of construction down. But from what I understand so far, I think it's a false economy in the sense that it's almost like starting another leaky building crisis. I mean, we have New Zealand standards. We have materials in New Zealand that must comply with New Zealand standards. And what they seem to be saying is we want to cut all the red tape. So what we'll do is we'll allow you to bring in materials from other jurisdictions that are trusted jurisdictions and that comply with, for example, you know, the Canadian standards if you're going to bring in some flashings or board or whatever from Canada. But my main question is why? I mean, why would you want to bring in materials from other jurisdictions if you're basically saying that they don't comply with New Zealand standards? If you want to bring in some Canadian flashings around windows that Rick mentioned or board or whatever, why not get it to comply with New Zealand standards? Because the main problem, you know, in which really precipitated the whole leaky building crisis was actually a relaxation of all these standards, including a relaxation of the building code. We used to have bylaws in which would show you how to build a house, and that was replaced by a very proscriptive building code. And the materials were part of that problem, along with obviously the workmanship and so on. So I think this, there's always a everyone wants to say, let's cut red tape, and it's quite a nice buzzword, and it sounds probably quite good coming from the politicians. But the cutting of red tape around consents, around New Zealand standards, around the building code and all that sort of stuff, the slimming down of all that legislation is what led to the leaky building crisis and may then lead to yet another crisis if this continues.
Often, as I said, we hear it's not the product, it was the way it was installed. I can think of a high-profile case right now going on in Australia involving a New Zealand company over this, right? And does that often come to the heart of debates of who's responsible, not just finger-pointing, but actually a genuine question that if you had followed these instructions and if you were experienced, this wouldn't have happened? Is it a fair point, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, the materials often come with installation instructions, and so yes, it's definitely comes down to the way in which the building is constructed. That is for sure. But you often get installation instructions with flashings and so on, and who's to say that those installation instructions coming from, you know, Canada, America, or whatever, are going to work in New Zealand? I mean, we have a New Zealand standard which is takes into account New Zealand conditions, and you have to get New Zealand approval. Why get something from America which doesn't comply with the New Zealand standard? I don't quite understand it.
Is it to save going through this process of having to make an application for an individual product and then having to go off to Brands or wherever, get it tested, possibly in an overseas lab? Is it simply about that? If it is trusted here, we should be able to bring it in, and there, we should be able to bring it in and use it here, Paul?
Well, I think, no, I mean, I just don't think that that's right. I mean, why not get it tested here? What is the problem? Is it resources? Does the New Zealand standards envy? Do they need more people, more labs, whatever? Why not? I mean, you know, the whole leaky building crisis started because we adopted a lot of the processes from Vancouver, and we imported fibre cement board. We got rid of eaves. There's a lot of poor installation of flashings, all that sort of stuff. Why open yourself up to that potential problem? If it's where you could probably just upskill the New Zealand sort of standards authority and somehow get these boards or materials fast tracked through the New Zealand system, which is based on New Zealand conditions.
Final observation here from a media statement. This is from Susanna Tillman of Manager Building Policy at MBIE. I quoted from it a little bit earlier, but there's one more here. Building consent authorities will still need to assess proposed building work to ensure products being used for their stated purpose and the building will comply with the building code. Product manufacturers and suppliers will continue to be responsible for the products they supply. Homeowners will still be afforded the existing protections of the building regulatory system. In practice, Paul, when something goes wrong, how's that going to work?
Yeah, that just means the product manufacturers will be responsible. Well, that's great. I mean, that's great for lawyers. You know, we'll make a lot of fees out of this, but it's probably not great for the homeowners, because all that means is that the product manufacturer is liable if their product goes wrong. Well, we don't want their product to go wrong. I mean, if it goes wrong, that's fine. They can get sued and off you go on a 5-year legal process, and you go through the remedial process and all that sort of stuff. But if you want to stop that, you don't want to start that in the first place. you have to make sure that your product, your materials, your workmanship, everything else is up to the tip-top standard, which will be based on New Zealand assessments.
Thank you, Paul. Rick, back to you. A couple of observations there. For these products, and we're talking all sorts of things, we're talking plumbing products and, as you say, and window flashings and all sorts of stuff. We're not just talking about jib, right? Correct. Is there an issue here with how long it takes to get a new product certified? And often you do have to use overseas labs, do you not, Rick?
Yeah, you can. You can use local or overseas labs. But and look, it's an expensive process. But the points Paul was making is dead right. Why we need to ensure these products are right before we use them. So I don't have a problem in principle with organisations who want to introduce a new product having to go through the process of testing. That protects the consumer and the contractor, for that matter. So I don't have a problem with that. And it's just we probably, and again, if we had bigger, stronger contractors, they would be looking for competitive advantage, as an example. So if they can find a new product that they believe is going to be cheaper and more effective, then they will test it, have it tested, and they will introduce it, and that gives them that advantage. But most of the contracting organisations are too, or most organisations in the industry overall are actually too small and haven't got the resources to pay for that testing and be afford to cover the time that it costs to go through the process. That's the fundamental issue.
We've been trying to resolve that issue of our fractured and unusual kind of construction industry for years with you, Paul. Sorry, Rick, I don't know that we've come up with an answer. Final point. Well, go ahead.
Yeah, well, sorry, I think it starts with an accreditation program process for contractors. So the capability and capacity of the contracting industry becomes transparent. And this is, I've actually had discussions with Minister Penk about this, and we were introducing that through the Construction Accord, which has been curtailed but is still in existence, and Minister Penk is listening to this organisation, the Construction Accord. And I think we need to, we can understand what our contractors are capable of, we get them stronger, then those that don't have the capacity or the capability will be absorbed by the larger ones or will die on the vine, and will ultimately end up with a larger, more professional and highly capable contractors. That's where we need to be.
Well, you've got contractors and then you've got subcontractors, remember, as well.
Correct.
Which also hits homeowners when something goes wrong with the building contractor or they're not paying, and then the subby says, sorry, I'm not finishing this job.
That's right.
What would that do, though, to availability for smaller jobs? Not just construction, but smaller jobs, Rick. I mean, I'm going to be on the phone forever trying to get my something fixed, don't I?
Yeah, you know, there's still a place for the smaller one-man band contractors, no question. But it's horses for courses. If you've got a plumber who's doing one house or a couple of three houses a year or whatever it is to keep him going, that's fine. As long as he's working for a contractor, a main contractor, who will stand behind that guy if he has a problem. The problem at the moment is if the plumber falls over, then the builder ends up carrying his liabilities. And so in most cases, the builder will fall over as well. That's what we've got to get away from. We've got to get away from that domino effect.
Final issue on the materials. We know all about the jib. Jib was worth more than gold when the supply chain was completely shut down. And I just want to know whether in more normal times, supply chain issues could become a thing again very quickly, but in normal times, do you believe this move by the government will bring prices down for materials?
No, not on its own, no.
Okay, thanks both of you. Really appreciate your time and your experience. Rick Hood and Paul Grimshaw. And as I said, the Building and Construction Minister, Chris Penk, is with us on Monday morning. You'll have heard this morning he has confirmed a bit of a kind of an open secret, it's been for a while, that the government is doing two things. It's going to extend the time for strengthening earthquake-prone buildings by 4 years. That'll be a mixed reaction from many people, I think, who are stuck in a building with no resolution, but they will not face having to demolish or be in breach of the law for another 4 years. And second, bringing forward a review of the current earthquake regulations. This is another story that we've covered in some depth, and Chris Penk will be talking to him about this and the construction industry on Monday morning.